Nilanjana, science isn't about danger. Unless the subject being studied is danger, then that's what science is about. The hooded figures, this centipede, you've gotten quite an appetite for bravery. If there's something threatening my town, then I will do what I have to do. My town? Where had that come from? I mean, this town, she said. I mean, any town, forget it. Why were the hooded figures there? Carlos said, in a voice far too loud for the small car, and stroked his chin, which was his subtle way of indicating that he was thinking. The hooded figures are attracted to the dog park, he said, which is a connection to the other world. It's possible they're attracted to areas that have been attacked because there's something about the other world in those pits. We know that the house that doesn't exist is connected to the other world. Let's see if there are hooded figures there, too. Carlos grimaced. The house that doesn't exist. Going inside it was such a mistake. I was trapped in that other world for a year. I didn't know if I would see anyone I loved ever again. I need to understand what happened to me and whether it could happen to anyone else in Nightvale. Somehow, that house is connected to the centipede, I think, and the city, and Pamela, and the church, and everyone connected with the church, even... She trailed off and checked her mirrors. Pamela still was following them. Behind Pamela was a black sedan driven by agents from a vague, yet menacing, agency. It wasn't unusual for any given car to be tailed by multiple spying cars. It was a common sight in Nightvale. Long processions of cars all tailing each other. But there was another vehicle, behind the black sedan, a beat-up white van. At this distance, she couldn't see who was driving, but it didn't look government-issued. Who was it, and why were they following her? "Could we go into the house?" she asked. "No, absolutely not, no. I know you found some spirit of daring-do in yourself, but... you would disappear into the desert otherworld and maybe never get back. I can't let anyone else get close to it. That's why I've been running remote experiments on it using my machine, or trying to, if these attacks would stop sabotaging them. I improved my machine yesterday by adding a long, corrugated metal cone, which tapers up to a small red ball. When I turn it on, visible electrical waves form around it, making sounds like zzzzt. What does the cone do? I just explained what it does. Weren't you listening? What I said was... He stopped. Nils?
What?
What's that van doing? The white van was pulling around the black sedan and Pamela's car. Pamela waved her fist at them, shouting about tortures so unimaginable no one had even thought to make them illegal. But they didn't seem to hear her. The van pulled up next to Nilanjana and honked its horn. Carlos looked straight ahead, trying not to acknowledge them. Nilanjana glared at the driver of the van. He had a huge, familiar mustache and a huge, familiar smile. The guard from the church. Next to him was Gordon, displaying his usual upsetting leer. The van accelerated away with a coughing roar. "Who was that?" "It doesn't matter," she said. It truly didn't. Let them spy on her. She wasn't afraid of them. "Look, we're almost there." She turned onto the cul-de-sac and pulled up to the house that doesn't exist. If she looked right at it, it looked like there was a house there, just like every other house on the block. But at the same time, it wasn't there. "What would happen if I knocked on the door?"
"Don't," Carlos said. "You might not like what answers."
"Fine, fine. I just needed to see the place for myself." What did it mean that a house she could see and smell and hear and touch did not exist? What would happen if someone tried to buy the house and move in? It was like that old real estate mantra, existence, existence, existence. "There," she shouted, pointing. A hooded figure meandered across the white pebbles that made up the front yard. They could hear the static from where they sat. "The hooded figures appear to be drifting toward entrances to the other world," Carlos said. "This means two probable things. One, the presence of the other world is especially strong now. The boundary between the two worlds is getting thinner.
Our work in understanding it is more urgent than ever. And two, she said, the pit at Big Rico's, and therefore all the other pits, are directly related to the other world.
Yes, he said.
Maybe it was like I thought, she said. Maybe the pits are caused by the giant centipede, but it's not moving underground. It's moving from the other world.
That is a possibility.
They were so caught up in their conversation that the loud knocking on the passenger side window was followed by a startled pulsing in their chests. It was Pamela, leaning over the car. Carlos rolled down his window.
We were warned about you, Pamela said. We were warned about the other world and about that monster that lives there. The wordsmith alerted us to all of this weeks ago. And after we heard from him, we knew we had to do anything to stop you, so keep that in mind. We will do anything to stop you.
She met both of their eyes, and behind her the static noise of the hooded figure grew louder. Two more hooded figures appeared, and then two more, drifting across the lawn.
Anything, Pamela reiterated, then returned to her purple PT Cruiser and drove away.
Nilanjana clutched the steering wheel tightly, trying to stay aware of the hooded figure's movements without looking at them directly.
Daryl said he just gave them a tract, that he was just trying to convert them, Nilanjana said quietly. But he's been on the church's side this whole time.
It would appear so, said Carlos. I'm sorry. I know you liked him. He didn't touch her because he himself didn't like being touched, and so did not like to comfort people that way. But he leaned toward her and gave her a kind and concerned frown.
It doesn't matter.
She was fine. Daryl was probably somewhere with Stephanie right now, laughing about how easily he had undermined her and how excited they were to summon this monster from another world.
I'm going to tell you something. Something I've never told anyone, Carlos said. Can I do that?
Absolutely. I've never told Cecil the whole truth about the other world, because I love him, and I don't want him to experience more pain than he has to. He experienced a year without me, and that is enough. But that is not all I endured.
Carlos, she said softly, meeting his eyes, what happened?
From the point of view of Night Vale, I was in the other world for a year. But time moves faster in the other world. From my point of view, it wasn't a year. It was 10 years. I spent 10 years not eating or drinking, not aging, not truly existing, just waiting in stasis, alone. Away from the people I love. It is a place that is empty and hollow. 10 years.
He shuddered. The first time she had seen him do that. His eyes were steady, but distant.
No one must ever go through what I experienced.
There was nothing she could say to make it better. Not even a little bit. And so she just said, Carlos, I'm so sorry.
Past the hooded figures, who now looked like bored, overdressed security guards, Nilanjana saw a light in the front window of the house.
It was daylight out, but she could tell the light was on because she could see a modest iron chandelier over a simple round wood dining table. On the table was a plain glass vase. A shadow moved across the back wall, and then a woman. There was a woman in the house. A woman in her 50s, wearing a simple flower print dress. The woman lifted the vase and placed some fresh flowers into it. She left the room and returned a moment later with a cup, with which she poured some water into the vase. She looked out the window for a moment, as if savoring the morning light. She stretched and yawned, but the yawn didn't end. Her jaw swung wider, and her arms got longer. She looked like she was caught in a black hole, helplessly elongating. Her mouth was half her body. Her arms bent backward as they pushed against the ceiling. Her eyes sank back into her skull. She was just a mouth, two empty eye sockets, and warped
arms creeping along the ceiling like vines. And then the woman dissolved, all of her, mouth and eye sockets and arms, into dust, which fell out of sight onto the living room floor.
Carlos, are you seeing this?
Nilanjana moved to clutch his shoulder and then, remembering, stopped herself.
Was all that real?
He shrugged. It happened in a house that doesn't exist, so, technically, no, I suppose.
27. The scientists want to study the smiling God, said Pastor Mann. They think there's something scientifically fascinating and absolutely terrifying about a giant centipede.
She looked at Daryl from across her desk. Gordon, who had returned from his surveillance mission in the van and was back at his usual place, behind her, glowered along.
Does that sound right to you? She asked.
He was uncertain if she meant correct or justified.
In my experience, Daryl said, scientists find everything scientifically fascinating. It's one of their best and worst habits. They're always shouting about how the entire universe is an extraordinary place, and that the vast sparkle of a nebula and the grinding burp of a broken blender are all part of a spectrum of things that exist, and how that is so unlikely and beautiful. He sighed.
It gets tiring, especially when you have been raised with the heady and inspiring stuff that is the smiling God coming to devour us all. The pastor narrowed her eyes above her friendly, natural smile, but it didn't have the effect she wanted because it was hidden by her huge hat. She removed her hat and narrowed her eyes again.
And what do the rest of you think? Is Daryl telling me the truth? Can we trust him? Or has he betrayed his faith?
Daryl was flanked by Stephanie and Jamila, and each one of them put a hand on him, claiming him as one of their own.
There's no one more invested in this community than our wordsmith, said Stephanie. No one has put in more volunteer hours or tithed more to support our foreign missions to Venezuela and Mexico and double Mexico.
I wish you could have seen the tons of hours he spent teaching our missionaries double Spanish, Jamila added.
It's the doubling of the vocal cords that's the tricky part, said Daryl. Once you're past that, it gets a lot easier.
Or, if you don't believe him, said Stephanie, believe me. You know that I want nothing more than to be a church elder. I wouldn't let anything get in the way of that goal, and I know that Daryl is loyal to the church.
The pastor said nothing more.
She tapped the tips of her fingers together thoughtfully. Gordon coughed.
Pastor, he said. Ma'am, you know I always am behind you 100%, no matter what, but, well, we've known Daryl since he was little. I taught several of his classes. He stayed with my wife and me for a few weeks right after the Ramirez's, after his folks, passed. I have watched him grow into a joyous, faithful follower of our smiling God.
The pastor did not change her neutral smile.
If you don't believe him, though, Gordon continued, I don't believe him, for sure. But if it was me, just me, on my own, I think I would believe him. He wrote our brochure for teeth's sake.
Thank you, Gordon, the pastor said, her tone gentle, but not inviting further feedback. And you, Daryl, what do you say for yourself?
Daryl paused and collected his thoughts. As good as he was at writing, he knew he could be deeply unconvincing when speaking. His sincerest thoughts sometimes seemed to convey ulterior motives or inappropriate tones, and now he needed to be as convincing as it was possible to be. He rode a slow breath in and out.
To me, there is no separation between the bodies in this room
and the belief in our hearts and jaws, he said. I think that what we believe and what we are, those are inseparable and singular. Every time I move my finger, it is a prayer. Every time Stephanie makes a joke and Jamila laughs, that is a prayer. Every song Gordon leads is a prayer. Every touch, every thought, every conflict, every moment of weakness even, is a prayer. The joyous congregation is everything that our lives are made of. I couldn't deny my faith any more than I could deny my skeleton. Couldn't leave it without leaving every minute that my friends and I have spent together. I love the people in this room, and with that same love, not the same level of love, but the same single impulse of love, I love the joyous congregation. I love the smiling God, and I love each of you. He looked into Gordon's eyes, and then into Pastor Munn's. He touched Stephanie's fingers on his shoulder. He held Jamila's non-power drill hand. I don't know if that answers your question. Jamila ran her power drill a little. She couldn't help it. Stephanie gave his shoulder a hard squeeze. Everyone but the pastor was crying. Pastor Munn was smiling. Daryl, she said, I knew you were special. You have always been special to this church. Not many of us in this generation grew up with the faith. Most of us drifted into the joyous congregation out of lives of temptation and heresy and bloodstone circles. But this faith raised you. She reached out a hand across the desk and he took it. It was a long reach for both of them. It was a really big desk. The smiling God does not know grudges. It does not understand transgression. It only knows hunger. It only devours. It is perfect that way. And you still have a place with all the rest of your siblings of the faith in the dark, acrid belly of the smiling God. Will you join us there? Yes, he said. Pastor, absolutely yes. She smiled at him. He widened his lips as far as they would go and showed his teeth. So did his friends and Gordon. They all showed their teeth to each other, indicating how happy all of them were. I have something important to show you, Pastor Munn said. But first, a blessing. Please stand, bow your heads, and keep your eyes firmly closed. Gordon, will you lead the prayer? Yes, which prayer are we? The one about the mark, she snapped. Okay, you heard the pastor. Eyes closed, heads down. O smiling God, who more than you hungers, who comes out of the sand like you and devours all it can see, who has larger teeth, who has more teeth, who else is an enormous centipede? No one. Only you, our gracious smiling God. As they recited the prayer, the pastor gave Gordon a tin of thick black paste that smelled a little like moss and a little like urine. None of the others had any idea what the paste was made from. It was made from crushed centipedes. But he smeared it under each of their right ears, drawing three interlocking triangles. So you are marked, may you be eaten, Gordon continued. So you are devout, may you be devoured. So you are together, may you be together within the stomach of our smiling God. To this we all say, they all said it, Amen. Well, great. Together we are the devout, the devoured, Pastor Munn said. That's super. You can all sit or whatever now. And hey, now I can show you the book. I want to show you the book. It's all happening so fast, it's quite exciting. Even Gordon seemed a bit wary at this. People in Night Vale are not comfortable with books in general, understanding that they are, in the best cases, wastes of time, and in the worst cases, traps left by the secret police to find out who the curious ones are so they can be removed from the population. Plus, Gordon was the only elder in the room. He was the one who should get to see whatever exciting book she was going to bring out. Deep down, he hated and feared books and would prefer never to have read them. But if anyone in this room deserved the right to get to read a book, it should be him. The pastor's desk had been empty before the prayer began, but now there was a huge tome bound in a leather none of them recognized. It was centipede skin. There was an intricate design made from nails driven into the cover, connected by bits of wire. "This is the Book of Devouring," she said, patting it proudly. Despite the vastness of her desk, the book seemed to take up a great deal of space. "With this, we will call upon our God. This is called the Invocation." "Where did the congregation get this book?" said Stephanie, interested as always in the academic side of things. She could not wait to become a church elder and be allowed to read the great histories, stories, and secrets of the church. "Have we always had it?" "It was written by the prophet Kevin," the pastor said. Kevin was a great figure in the history of the church. He had once been a radio host in a town called Desert Bluffs, until one day he had found an old oak door. He had gone through that door and had entered heaven, where he had met the smiling God. When he returned, it was with the message of the smiling God, a message that he spread through his radio shows until he disappeared. It was said that he had returned to heaven to join the smiling God there. Kevin loved the smiling God more than anyone, and he was able to observe its habits. And from that, he wrote this book. And this book was passed down to me. I mean, not passed down for long. We're not an old religion.
"Really aren't," said Jamila.
"Relatively recent," said Stephanie.
"But we are the first religion with the gratifying knowledge that we have found it, the true explanation for everything. Centuries of searching, and we hold the answer here, in our hands."
"Joyfully," said Gordon, holding up his hands and closing his eyes.
"So joyfully," said Stephanie.
Jamila ran her power drill.
"Joyfully," said the pastor, placing both hands on the book in front of her.
Daryl stood. He was crying, and his smile was wider than it had ever been. He looked to the needlework on the wall, hanging uncharacteristically crooked. He repeated its boisterous message.
"Joyfully," he said. "It devours."
28. Nilanjana sat straight up in bed, panting, sweating. She was cold. It was bright out. She had slept through the sunrise somehow. She had had a terrible dream. Like most dreams, it was lasting and memorable, but only in the part of the brain that hides information. The part of the brain that takes drama and trauma and buries it like whatever those specks are that grow into things. She still didn't remember what they were called. Where it can grow over time into something that takes on a larger, more distinct shape, unrecognizable from its original form. Daryl had been in the dream, but she couldn't remember what he had been doing. She only knew that she didn't trust him. It was too late in the morning to even think about getting back to sleep. She was discombobulated from the nightmare, the components of which had dissolved so much she could only assume it was a nightmare based on her body's current state. Clammy arms and chest, sweat on her upper lip, the kind of headache that doesn't hurt, but that makes your head feel like styrofoam, and a deep worry for something or somebody unknown. She and Carlos had been up late last night going over the information they had. Hooded figures were attracted to entrances to the other world. They had been attracted to the pit at Big Rico's. So this pit had something to do with the other world. It was possible that the pits were being created by the movements of a giant, devouring centipede that was worshipped as a smiling god. If so, then this centipede was related to the other world. But what was the city's role? Why did Pamela keep showing up around these disasters? And what motive would a centipede have to disrupt Carlos's experiments? On a motive level, it was more likely that the city was behind these attacks. But then, how was the centipede involved, if at all? Back and forth, until the night became technically morning. Although this had more to do with the imperfect labeling created by humans than with any change in the actual nature of the night. Nilanjana had apparently fallen asleep with the television on. She almost never watched television. She had a television and a cable subscription because it was mandatory for all Nightvale citizens to own a television and pay for cable. Even though she didn't think of herself as a citizen of Nightvale, the law still applied to her. This was fine by Nilanjana, as she didn't mind paying taxes and government fees if they were supporting the less fortunate. Cable television executives had fallen on difficult times in the last few years, and were now the most poverty-stricken demographic. So at least the money she paid for cable was going to a good cause, even if she didn't watch it much. But this morning, the television was on. It was the Channel 6 local news with Tim and Trin. They were identical half-insects in identical suits, like all news anchors. And the second most trusted source for news in Nightvale, after Cecil's radio show, which was the heart of the community. And well ahead of the Nightvale Daily Journal, which had an editorial stance against differentiating fiction and journalism. Everyone loved Tim and Trin because, as many citizens said, they really speak to me. And this was true. Tim and Trin often spoke directly to people who were watching the news. Sometimes a viewer might watch a story in disbelief, or smile at a cute feature on animal adoptions, or cry because a news item affected them personally. It was in those moments that Tim and Trin would address that person directly and tell them, "It's going to be fine, Tavin." Or, "It's not okay, but you can only make change in your own life, Diane." Or, "That dog is cute, right, Earl? You should get a dog. You'd be happy with a dog." Channel 6 also had the government-enforced power to turn on at any time in any home. Sometimes this was to present important news events, like an Amber Alert. Sometimes it was because ratings were low that period, and they needed some juice. Either way, Nilanjana thought, it was possible that she hadn't fallen asleep watching television. The television could have just turned itself on to Channel 6. "Still missing despite the sheriff's secret police efforts to find him," was the first thing Nilanjana processed Tim, or maybe Trin, saying. "The police have found no sign of Larry or even his home. Both were reported missing a week ago by a citizen named Erica, who also claimed to be an angel," said Trin. Possibly Tim.
"Ha ha ha ha! There are no such things as angels, Trin," said Tim.
"Great, now I know which is which," Nilanjana thought.
"No, there certainly aren't, Tim," said Trin. "And the police have taken this supposed angel, Erica, into custody for illegally proclaiming the existence of themselves."
"We are getting a report right now that Erica escaped police custody by flying up and away to the heavens using their great feathered wings. Witnesses said they could hear what sounded like a French horn and a children's choir."
"People will go to any lengths to protect their delusions, won't they, Tim?"
"Ha ha ha," said Tim, slapping the desk with a human hand.
The nail on Tim's right ring finger was 3 inches long and painted in green and black stripes. Tim repeated after a breath.
"If you have seen Larry Leroy out on the edge of town,
please call the number below.
At the bottom of the screen was a phone number. Next to Trin's triangular face was a photo of Larry. He was smiling, his forehead glistening. The flash was too bright. The smile was the artificial smile of a posed picture, the kind of lip curl that happens when a person calls to the group, "Okay, everybody, say broken feet," and then everyone says broken feet, and somehow that is supposed to generate a natural happy face. Nilanjana could see Larry's diorama over on her bookshelf, the diorama she'd found in the desert where his home used to be. The crisp details of Dorothy's face, the accurate texture of the aluminum sides of her war balloon, the fires of what had once been Kansas below her. Nilanjana could almost make out individual houses, children, and dogs on lawns. Larry's coloring demonstrated a masterful gradient of an unseen setting sun. Bright yellows and oranges, fading to ochre and mauve with long shadows. In his art, he communicated life. Journalists and orators must use language to craft their understanding of the world. Nilanjana and other scientists had to use numbers and gather data to form a structure for the universe. Larry used color and strokes and gentle hands to build his worlds. No historian or novelist could, in 1,000 pages, verbalize a story quite as rich as one of Larry's shoebox-sized dioramas. Each one a masterpiece, Nilanjana thought. She was crying now. It was fine. She was just exhausted from a nightmare she couldn't remember. She felt for Larry. She didn't know him. Nobody knew him. He made brilliant art, and it was in no museum, no magazine. He had no children and lived as far from the city as one could live and still live in Nightvale. He had so much to give the world, and no one knew what that so much was. It was only in his death, eaten by a centipede, murdered by the city council, that anyone could see what he had made. Not even a body or ruins of a house, just a pit, marking where all of that had been buried. And this diorama, inert and private in her home, the sole evidence left of his gifts. She promised when all of this was resolved, she would make sure Nightvale knew who Larry was and what he had created. "I promise, Larry," Nilanjana said at the diorama.
"What do you promise?"
Tim asked from the television screen.
"What?" "Tim wants to know what you promised, Nilanjana. Did you just talk to that diorama?" "What? No, I..."
"That's an excellent diorama. Did you make it?"
Tim asked.
"No."
Nilanjana did not want them to think she had been out digging through Larry's stuff. The pit was a crime scene, after all.
"I mean, yes."
"Hey! So what are you doing with Daryl?"
"Yeah, what's going on with you two?"
Tim asked, forgetting about the diorama.
"You make a cute couple."
And here a photo appeared next to Tim's face, showing the couple, both in sunglasses, exiting Nilanjana's apartment building.
"Hey, I'm not a public figure. You can't run photos like that."
"Sounds like forbidden love, Tim."
Trin grinned. Was that a grin?
"Two young lovers, one a logical scientist, the other a member of one of the most evangelical churches in Nightvale."
"Quite star-crossed, these two,"
Tim added, their one long nail gently caressing Trin's left hand. Trin did not acknowledge it. Nilanjana didn't want to talk about Daryl right now. At her most positive, she tried to think of him as a means to an end, a way to find out what the church was up to. More often, she thought of him as a mistake. Mostly, she tried not to think of him at all.
"Yes, Tim. Wrapping up. In final news, Pamela Winchell, director of emergency press conferences for the city,"
her image appeared on the screen,
"is holding an emergency press conference about the Great Bottomless Pit, which appeared a few moments ago in the floor of the Nightvale High School gymnasium."
"What?" Nilanjana leapt up.
"Yes. Pamela's quite excited to have a real emergency to hold a press conference about. Most of her press conferences tend to be
existential emergencies, bigger picture issues, less specific to...
No, the gym. What happened at the gym?
We're getting to that. Don't interrupt. Also, we can see you, Nilanjana. Maybe put some pants on,
Tim said. She scrambled for the blankets.
I'm just playing,
Tim laughed.
But please, put your pants on.
This morning, during basketball practice, the floor of the NVHS gymnasium disappeared. Several students and faculty disappeared along with it.
Janice was on the school's wheelchair basketball team and was an equipment manager and trainer for the varsity team. What if she had gotten hurt or was one of the missing? And Carlos, oh, Carlos must be beside himself right now. Or what if he didn't even know yet? She needed to go. She scrambled around for clothes, muttering, shit, shit, shit.
Calm down, Nils. Don't tell me to calm down, and don't call me Nils, Timmy,
Nilanjana snapped.
No, I'm Tim, the other one said.
The screen cut to a shot of a student outside the high school being interviewed. The Chiron said, Misty Alvaretto, Junior.
I was in band and felt a rumbling under us. I thought it was really great because I had finally pressed down all the valves correctly on my baritone, and I thought that had unlocked some great mystery, that perhaps the firmament had split to reveal a face, and that face had spoken, and the great truths in its words had shaken the ground, just like our old music teacher, Louis Blasco, used to tell me would happen when I finally mastered my instrument, but the rumbling was something else entirely.
It destroyed the floor of the gym, Misty said.
So I guess I didn't press the buttons in the right order. I don't know how brass instruments work.
Did you know anyone in the gym at the time this happened? The off-screen reporter asked.
What? In sports? No. Probably not. Is basketball a sport?
Yes, it is, the reporter said. That's who was practicing.
Then yes.
Misty's face did not change. Nilanjana had gotten her pants on and grabbed her keys.
Shit, 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 she repeated.
Well, Trin, it's a horrible story. Just tragic,
Tim said.
Yes, absolutely. Children are our future, after all. They are a noisy and unruly future, full of unearned self-confidence and silly ignorance. Children are quite an unintelligent future.
Yes.
Shit.
Nilanjana was trying to call Carlos. She had the phone to her ear as she was pulling on her shirt.
Carlos, are you watching the news? She said into his voicemail. We already told Carlos, Nilanjana. Why would we not have told Carlos?
Nilanjana couldn't see which one said it. She was already at the front door.
Carlos, I'm on my way to the school. Please call. Let me know Janice is okay. I'm so sorry.
She let the front door slam shut behind her, forgetting to lock it or even fasten the belt she was wearing. Her bag and hair and shoelaces and belt buckle waved behind her like battle flags as she ran. Her heart pulsed in her ears, and she felt the sweat on her upper lip like a cold mustache. Inside on the television, Tim said,
For more on this, let's go to Emma in sports. Emma? What does a gaping pit in the middle of their practice court and the loss of almost all of the players do to this team's chances to make the playoffs?
29. Almost the entire gymnasium floor was gone. A deep pit now. Only the bleachers were left, with students scattered across them. Two students were huddled together, their faces puffy from crying. They had their arms on each other's shoulders and were slowly rocking, heads down and silent. Another group of kids were clearing away the debris, chunks of wood planks and pieces of plexiglass backboard. Several of the sheriff's secret police were conducting interviews of their own for a full report. They were asking students questions like, You didn't see anything, right? And, You're not that reliable, are you? Three other students were helping fix a broken wheelchair.
A broken wheelchair? Janice,
Nilanjana thought. Her face flushed, her eyes itched, and she involuntarily rubbed her chest as she tried to breathe normally.
Janice, she thought again as she scanned the room.
Her eyes fell upon Carlos in the doorway, with Cecil and Steve and Abby. Steve had his big arm over Carlos's shoulder. Cecil had his arm around Carlos's waist while trying to nudge Steve's arm away. Nilanjana hurried toward them as best she could along the bleachers.
"Janice,"
she said, as she got to them. Carlos, too overwhelmed to speak, only let his mouth dangle open, saying nothing, and Nilanjana felt some vital part of her heart snap. Thankfully, Abby, who approached life with an absolute practicality and who wouldn't let herself collapse with the trauma of the moment until hours later when she was alone in the shower, pointed to the handball court. Janice was sitting there, staring at the handball wall, not talking.
"She's okay," said Abby, "or physically at least.
The collapse damaged her wheelchair, but some of the kids are working on that."
"I'm so glad," Nilanjana said, knowing it sounded monstrously understated,
but not knowing how else to express that she was really fucking glad.
"Us too," said Steve, understanding exactly what she meant.
Immediate concern addressed, she scanned the scene for any new information that could be collected. Among the crying parents and students, and the sand drifting up from the pit, she saw a kiwi bird. She did a double take. The kiwi bird wasn't moving, just watching everyone around the gym. She got closer to examine it. She couldn't be looking at a kiwi, as they are not native to Night Vale, or America for that matter, but she was. The bird turned and looked at her.
"Hey," said the bird, "it's Josh from the pizza place."
"Josh, I'm sorry I didn't. It's just last time you looked different."
"I've been trying out the bird thing lately. I don't know.
It looks cool," she said. It did look cool. Birds are cool looking.
"Maybe."
He seemed unconvinced by her compliment, while also happy to have gotten it.
"Are you okay?"
She sat next to him.
"I'm fine, I guess. I mean, physically. The team was warming up. A few players were still in the locker room. I was sitting in the stands watching. My boyfriend is on the team, but he wasn't on the court yet. If he was, I don't know. That's him over there trying to fix our friend's wheelchair. Hey, Grant!"
One of the boys near the wheelchair looked up toward the bleachers. He kept scanning but could not spot Josh. Josh stood in place, not doing anything.
"Oh, damn it," he said. "I don't have visible wings like this. He can't see me wave. Also, when we arrived at school this morning, I was a brown bear."
Nilanjana waved to Grant and pointed to Josh. Grant seemed to get it and gave a slight smile. But then the smile was lost again in the shock.
"What happened to the floor, Josh?" "I felt the building shaking, and the floor got hot, scalding even. I was in the bleachers, but it was radiating all the way up. I didn't say anything because I thought it was just me. But then I looked down at guys on the court, and they were all staring at the floor and moving their legs and arms up and down frantically. I panicked and didn't move. I couldn't react in time. I could have saved people."
"Josh, it's natural to not know what to do in a moment like that. Don't feel bad."
"Janice Palmer reacted in time, though. That's her over there. She started shouting at the players to get in the bleachers. She was, like, really on it. Getting everyone she could off the hardwood. And then the whole floor was gone."
Janice was right on the edge. I was sure I was going to watch her fall. And Michael Shoemaker, he's the tall one, he plays center. He held out his arm, and she grabbed it and pulled herself up into the bleachers. That's Michael down there with Grant fixing her wheelchair.
"Did you see any movement or anything else when the hole appeared?"
"Movement?
Like an animal or machine or anything else moving underground that could have caused the hole?"
Josh clacked his beak thoughtfully.
"No, I don't think so. It happened so fast, though. I heard that sound, and then the floor was gone."
"What sound? What did you hear?"
"It was like, Josh!"
A voice came from below.
A crying woman in her mid-30s ran at them along the third row of the bleachers.
Oh, God, you're okay. Josh, come here.
Mom! Josh protested as she picked up the kiwi and held it tight to her chest and neck. She stroked his head.
Mom!
He grunted. I'm sorry. I shouldn't grab you when you are in a smaller physical state like that. Motherly instincts and all.
I'm not a kid.
He was embarrassed to have this happen in front of an adult with whom he had just been having an adult conversation.
Twice, Josh, that's twice you could have been killed by one of these pits, she said, and then turned to Nilanjana.
Hi, Diane Creighton. Nilanjana Sikdar, I'm a scientist. I'm researching what's causing these pits. I was interviewing Josh about what happened here.
I know you. You're from Carlos's lab.
I guess we're both lucky today. Thanks for keeping my son company. Diane embraced her son once more, kissing his tiny feathered head.
I know I said you're not allowed to grow wings and fly without an adult around. But if another one of these pits forms, you grow the biggest wings you can and fly far away.
Okay, Mom. Can you put me down?
Promise?
Diane put him down.
Mom!
He whined. At that moment, Jackie Fierro tore through the gym door and joined the embrace.
Dude, you're okay, she said. I'm sorry it took me so long. I'm a shitty sister. I was driving Laura on some errands on account of I offended her a few days ago. Man, I'm so glad to see your feathered ass in one piece.
Nilanjana felt it was better to let them have the moment alone. Also, there was a commotion out on the asphalt. Pamela Winchell stepped up onto a tall podium for a press conference. Nilanjana walked closer to hear her speech, as did most everyone else. A few camera flashes went off.
No pictures, please,
Pamela said. The camera stopped flashing. She frowned.
This doesn't feel right. Something doesn't feel right. There are usually a bunch of bright flashes and clicking sounds when I'm on a podium, but I don't see or hear them now.
Her assistant, a woman named Trish Hidge, loudly whispered,
You told them no pictures. Those flashes and clicks are pictures.
Ah, ha, ha, I see, Pamela said into the mic. No pictures, but please make your cameras click and flash. I need the clicks and flashes in order to do this, but no pictures.
A few moments passed as the photographers in the group tried to figure out how to make their cameras do that without taking pictures. Then the press conference proceeded.
Hello, people of Night Vale. Hello, people of Earth. Hello, ghost people of the heavens and hells and in-betweens. Hello, starry gods of the night sky, hidden by the bright blue sky and the bright yellow sun. I have called this press conference to...
She paused.
Why is the sky blue when the sun is yellow? Shouldn't the sky be yellow?
A strong touch of frustration in her voice.
This makes no sense. Trish! Find out why that is and get back to me. Interrupt whatever I'm doing to tell me. It doesn't matter if I'm delivering a press conference or sleeping or dying. I apologize for that tangent. Where was I? Right. I was at home. Then I was in my car. Next, I was at the high school. I'm still at the high school. That helps. See what I did? I examined history to find out more about the present. As the saying goes, those who fail to understand history are doomed, as are those who do understand it. It was Emma Goldman who said that, and Emma Goldman should know, for she eventually died, and we still don't know what she had to do with today's tragedy. Sheriff Sam and their secret police are doing a fine job investigating this disaster. They've been shouting at the pit, and I believe Sam has tried shooting at it. The mayor and her staff are also doing a great job. Everyone's doing well at their jobs. You are too. Maybe. I haven't investigated you as much as I maybe should have.
Trish leaned to the podium again and whispered.
I am being told to take questions, Pamela sighed. Give me some questions, I suppose.
One reporter asked, What caused the floor of the gym to get destroyed?
How would I know? Next question.
Have any witnesses of the accident described what happened?
I'm positive they have. If you were part of something like this, wouldn't you want to describe it?
What does the city plan to do next?
I can't speak for the city. But I am hoping to finally read Leo Sashin's Remembrance of Earth's Past trilogy.
Speaking for the city is literally your job.
No more questions!
Pamela spotted Nilanjana in the crowd, and after a tense moment of eye contact, Pamela gestured at her. The gesture was something like finger scissors, followed by a bobbling of the head, followed by an attempt to touch her neck with her tongue, which she did easily. Nilanjana was clearly confused, so Pamela shouted across everyone,
"Meet me in a less populated part of the schoolyard where I can talk to you! Secretly!" "What have you done?" Pamela demanded to know once they were alone.
She was leaning sharply into Nilanjana's personal space. Pamela had one finger held out only inches from Nilanjana, as if she were about to start poking her in the chest, but the finger came no closer.
"What have I done? What have you done?"
Nilanjana pointed her own finger back. She had had it up to here with this city, and most everyone who lived here.
"You are trying to stop Carlos from doing his experiments, but is it worth all this?"
"Of course we're trying to stop Carlos, to prevent his relentless poking around from letting that thing into Nightvale."
"The centipede?"
"I don't know all your big scientific words. That thing the wordsmith warned us about."
"Daryl."
"You just said it was a centipede."
"No, Daryl is the wordsmith."
"Oh, that's right."
Pamela slapped her head, hard. A little bit of blood bubbled above her ear.
"Wordsmith was way easier to remember. Daryl's such a dull name. Dull Daryl." "Huh, an alliteration. That'll help. Dull Daryl."
She slapped her head again. There was now a thin stream of blood running down her neck onto her blouse.
"You said he warned you about us. What did Daryl tell you?"
"He didn't tell us anything. He didn't need to. We interpreted the warning. We thought he was there to convert us, gave us a pamphlet describing the smiling god, but the city council, they themselves are otherworldly monsters, so they recognize one when it's described. They understood from the pamphlet that a terrible creature lives in the desert otherworld, and so no one must interact with that place or do anything at all that might let that creature enter our world. What did you call it? Daryl?"
"Centipede. Daryl is a human."
"Whatever. Let that creature be. Let the otherworld be."
Nilanjana had to take a moment to restructure her hypothesis around this new piece of data.
"Wait. You're trying to stop the creature from attacking Nightvale this way. So none of these pits have been caused by you?"
"Of course not," said Pamela. "We're trying to stop giant whatever you call them from coming into this world. You think I want to see kids eaten by a monster? What kind of person do you think I am?"
"I don't know," said Nilanjana. "I don't know what kind of person I think you are."
"That's terrible if you thought I would do this."
Pamela seemed truly hurt.
"But then, we're on the same side. We're both trying to stop that creature from doing this."
"Let your government take care of it," Pamela said.
"You've been handling it for 2 weeks, and people are dying. It's because of how you're handling it that people are dying."
Pamela's face sagged. She was trying to keep herself together.
"You're a hurtful person,"
she managed after a deep, careful breath, and walked away.
What a strange woman, Nilanjana thought.
And, she also thought, if the city is also trying to prevent the attacks, then I am left with one possible party with an interest in keeping these events going. The church and its monstrous insect have been devouring Nightvale, bit by bit. It was time to end that, and to end them. She returned to the gym to check on Carlos. He was leaning into Cecil's chest. It was just the two of them, alone and together. She let them be. Carlos was particular about how he liked to be touched. Only in certain places, only for so long. Sometimes it felt nice when Cecil stroked his ears,
Then, the next day, the feeling of anyone touching his ears was unbearable. He could not predict his own responses. In this moment, all he knew was that he wanted to be inside that combination of hair and skin and scent that was Cecil's chest. He put his face right into the breastbone and breathed in. It smelled like home. "This has to be stopped," Carlos murmured. "Almost Janice, almost Janice." Cecil placed a hand atop Carlos's head, a kind of shelter over his frightened husband. Cecil's eyes were closed and his face calm. His voice was soothing and firm. "Janice is strong," said Cecil, "stronger than us. She'll be okay, and your science has saved Night Vale so many times, you'll find a solution." "No matter what," said Carlos. "I've been letting whoever is trying to distract me and sabotage me win. Nothing will stop me from here on out. I won't let Janice down. I won't let you down." Cecil drew Carlos's face up with a gentle hand. "We believe in you," Cecil said, and kissed his left cheek. "We love you." He kissed his right cheek. "I love you." He kissed his lips. For the first time in weeks, Carlos forgot his work, his worries, and his world. His universe was a kiss, and he explored that universe thoroughly. 30. As she drove back home from the high school, Nilanjana passed a white van parked a few houses down. It was the van from the Joyous Congregation. When she passed, its engine started, and it slid into traffic behind her. "God damn it," she thought. "Not this time." She pulled into the parking lot at Staples. "Life is a hallucination. Buy some pens. Who cares?" The van pulled in after her. She drove toward the entrance as if going to park, but then pulled a quick U-turn and drove toward the street again. The van, in its slower, bulkier way, turned after her. But she had no interest in losing them. Quite the opposite. She accelerated toward the entrance of the lot, and just before rocketing out into traffic, she slammed on the brakes and turned the wheel hard. Her car skidded sideways and blocked the van's path. The van stopped. It seemed the driver was uncertain what to do next. There was no other exit back to the main street. The van couldn't leave. Plus, she was not behaving in a normal, person-being-followed-by-an-unmarked-van sort of way. She turned the car toward the van and gunned the engine. The van started reversing. A car in the street honked at her, trying to turn into the lot. She gave them a gesture that indicated, in a direct way, that their concerns were not her priority. She let off the brake and lurched after the reversing van. The curbs around the lot were high, and there were wide planters between the lot and its surroundings. The van couldn't get through that way. Instead, it shifted into drive and turned toward the Staples. For a moment, she thought the van was going to drive right through the glass front doors, but they cut left at the last second. She could see them turning into the delivery lane at the end of the building, which led to the loading docks in back. Instead of continuing the chase, she decided she could cut them off. She left her car behind and ran into the store. As the doors of Staples slid open, she felt the artificial winter of retail air conditioning. Inside, the psychological experts of capitalism had created a meandering path that forced the customer through a maze of products to get from entrance to cashier. She didn't have time for that. She started pushing over racks as she ran, heading straight for the back. "Hey!" shouted Hank, the sentient patch of haze who was floor manager that day. "You can't do that!" She already had done it. She broke through into one of the wide aisles and tore to the back wall, where she pushed open the door into the employees-only area. "You can't go in there!" Hank drifted after her. "And you need to move your car!" Her reply was the slap of the employee door closing. "I hate this place," Hank muttered, sending out a tendril of haze to clean up the racks she had tipped over.
I need to get a job where I don't have to interact with humans.
Nilanjana beat the van to the back delivery area. Behind the store, there was a low concrete block wall, which she leapt over, landing in shrubs and tripping herself onto an asphalt alley road. She fell hard on her shoulder, but